Support for WPR comes from Focus on Energy, committed to helping Wisconsinites focus on the planet by making smart energy choices. Energy resources for Earth Day and every day can be found at focusonenergy.com.
Welcome to Spectrum West, y'all, where perennial April showers fall. It's okay to concede some passing bad habits, like jelly beans and large chocolate rabbits. This week on Spectrum West, another of the Eau Claire Jazz Festival headliners, we have two members of New York Voices, well known and revered for their close jazz harmonies and amazing rhythm. Darman Meter and Lauren Kinnon are here. Jim Oliver says hello to Susan Colley, director of the upcoming Menominee Theater Guild production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? And Jim will round out the business of other West Wisconsin theater companies as well. Austin Northhagen is director of the UWEC Student Office of Sustainability, instigators of a bike share program for the city of Eau Claire. He's here with an update this week. And here's a voice you just might recognize.
Don't tell me not to live, just sit and putter. Life's candy and the sun's a ball of butter. Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade. Don't tell me not to fly.
Barbara Streisand is no slouch, so if you're going to make audiences feel like you're the closest they might ever get to one of her shows, you'd also better be no slouch. Melody Bendis, a Twin Cities entertainer, takes on the Streisand persona in a show called Hello Gorgeous, an intimate tribute to the music of Barbara Streisand. She plays the Heidi Center in Chippewa Falls next Saturday evening, April 27th, and join me for some phone time that began with a mention of something called the Sunburst Convention of Celebrity Impersonators. What is that like?
Oh my gosh. It's a tribute's dream, because you have people ranging in all kinds of tributes. You have the lookalikes. Basically, you can find any lookalike. And there's two different types of tributes. There's ones who just do the lookalikes. So when they're being featured, Greg, who's in charge of it, does these really fun interviews, and they're in character. And it's just mind-blowing, because I got starstruck there, even though my brain told me, Melody, these aren't the real people. But someone would walk in, my heart would start just pounding, because I'm like, wait a minute, no, Melody, it's not the real person. And I remember when we would have lunches, I just wanted to sit down with all these different people and just actually, like, engage, because I was just amazed.
Do they keep it at one impersonator per celebrity, or did you hang out with other Barbara Streisand people?
There was one other Streisand, which was really fun, because she's been a staple there since the convention started. Of course, I was a little bit nervous. I'm like, oh my gosh, can you have, you know, more than one, you know, tribute artist, you know, being featured? And in fact, they support one another. I think one year, it was an unprecedented amount of Marilyn Monroe. It must have been about 15. Like, you could not believe. And, you know, and this one Marilyn, somehow her luggage got lost because she flew down to Orlando. And the other, and she had a showcase, and the other Marilyns banded together, gave her tracks to perform. Like, oh, what songs are you singing? Let me get you a costume together.
Wow.
And they all just, like, helped her. And I thought, that's amazing. What I love about being down there, and I'm going down again this year, is just the friends that you make. As an entertainer, I'm really full of heart and giving, and I have a pretty thin skin, I think, just because I really put myself out there, you know, and I was just so happy and relieved to find so many great people. You know, we're embracing one another and encouraging and, and not being cutthroat.
The other thing that I can see would be cool at one of these is you, as Barbara Streisand, doing a duet with a Frank Sinatra.
Oh, I know. In fact, at these conventions, you can do that.
Are there Frank Sinatra guys down there?
Oh, yes. You know, that's another, you know, tribute that's pretty popular, especially down in Florida, because you have the Rat Packs, you know, and in Vegas, and, you know, people coming together and forming these shows. So my girlfriend, who does Lady Gaga, did a duet with Frank Sinatra last year.
Sure.
And that was really good. And I actually added Lady Gaga onto my roster.
Uh-huh.
And so I felt like I needed to ask permission. I was like, Angela, is it okay? And she's like laughing at me. She's like, yes, and I'll help you with your makeup. I'm like, okay, just want to be sure. Even though she's down there in Florida, like, it's funny.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You realize that there are so many jobs. Not everyone can do every job. And so, you know, why not support one another and make each other better?
Sure.
And,
yeah.
You know, and for some reason, maybe she can't do a job and I can, or I can get her a job. So
mm-hmm.
I guess that's that community I was telling you about. That's just so spectacular.
Let's digress a little bit. Tell me how the Barbara, how did the Barbara notion begin? I mean, did someone mention a physical resemblance? You sang her songs and you had an epiphany? What happened?
All of the above. This journey has been like a lifelong journey that has finally culminated in the last couple of years. But anyway, as a child, I used to imitate Barbara Streisand and imitate various artists from Manhattan Transfer. But I just had an affinity for Barbara because I grew up in the 80s, and that's when her Guilty album was really on top. Oh, my gosh, I can imitate. This is amazing. But in some way, I kind of found that to be part of my vocal training by imitating her and other artists. Then I went into actual classical training when I was a teenager and then moved into the classical route. And I kind of shelved that for a long time. And it wasn't until a couple of years ago when the owner of Boogie Wonderland sat with me and said, hey, you know, you look like Barbara Streisand. You could do a 70s Barbara and we could showcase you. He's like, I really think you should do this. And then I was like, yeah, that sounds great. Okay, you know, and I didn't really take it really seriously. I think the hesitation was that it's such big shoes to fill. I knew I could sing classical. I knew I had the chops. But just to actually do it, it's like, oh, my gosh, what if people actually come to my show?
Yeah.
It wasn't fear of failure. It was fear of success.
When people come to the show to see, are they hell-bent on wanting to see exactly the same impersonation, or are they, you know, that is good. Are they open-minded as to how you're going to do it?
That is really a fantastic question. I've found it's all about the illusion, and I'll try to get to that question, but I'm kind of seeing it from my side.
Okay.
I can sound like Barbara Streisand. I can sound like a young Barbara Streisand. I can sound like a more mature, deliberate Barbara Streisand as she's gone, and I can have those looks. I also worried about that, by the way. I'm like, okay, what is this about? I'm finding that even if I don't look identical, and I get pretty close in the illusion visually, if I sound and sing like her, people are just, they're like right in it. In fact, I do this tracked movie show, and I was kind of nervous about it because I start off with playing a young Barbara Streisand going into a song, and she's like, I got 36 expressions. Sweet as pie and tough as leather. And then six expressions more than all those Barrymores put together. You know, all of a sudden, it's Barbara. And then I have to come out and sing Greatest Star. And I thought, ooh, what if people go, wait, that's not the woman. That's not the voice. And my director assured me, he's like, Melody, it will blow their mind. I'm like, okay, I'm going to put my trust and my faith in this. And sure enough, the first time I did it, all the comments that I received, they were shocked. They're like, oh, my gosh, I thought that was you. That recording was you.
Cool.
And then I came out, and I'm like, oh, that's so cool. Because you got to be so careful with that stuff. Even if they're not completely hooked in the beginning, as you go through the show, at some point, they just kind of fall into it.
Sure.
And they think that they're experiencing the real Barbara. You know, at some point, that happens. People never say, oh, my gosh, you shouldn't do Barbara Streisand. No.
That's a very good sign, yes, if people say that. That's wonderful. You know, and for the record, I want to tell you that a few minutes ago, I closed my eyes and I thought, wow, I'm talking to Barbara Streisand. And I kind of got chills. And so you're doing a good job. On the phone with Melody Mendes. Her show was called Hello Gorgeous, an intimate tribute to the magic of Barbara Streisand. I'm curious about the whole cabaret concept, and I'm going to ask you about Le Pain Agile. That's huge. Cabaret is a certain way and place of performance, more casual than a theater setting. I mean, people have heard the word cabaret for all their lives, but they might not know exactly what it is. cabaret setting, people possibly eating and drinking. So the Le Pain Agile Cabaret in Paris. A couple of weeks ago on the show, we featured a Jim Oliver segment about Steve Martin's play.
Oh, yes.
with that place in the title. And I went to the website. I mean, man, it's like performing in someone's living room. It's cool.
It's amazing. I actually sat in at the Le Pain Agile. I had a vacation with my husband, and I brought my sheet music just in case, because you never know.
Sure.
And they were on break, and I was like, oh, can I do some American jazz from the great songbook? And they're like, oh, sure. So I did a couple of songs, a couple of traditional American jazz songs, and that place is amazing. You're right. To answer your question about cabaret, I know there are lots of different definitions of cabaret, but in terms of singing and that type of performance, you're really breaking the fourth wall, and you do have an intimacy. In fact, you know, you can have a cabaret room within a huge performance space. It's all about connecting to the audience and looking at them and telling the story. And then you have this shared story together in the reaction.
Mm-hmm.
My barber shows are very cabaret because I do connect to the audience. I talk to them. I look at them. It's like the audience is seeing their own story through your stories and your songs. It's just a wonderful art form. And it's so open because it's just all about setting up a song and creating that moment and singing it and just that honesty.
After researching it, I decided I want more cabaret in my life. And so
I think that's a great idea. Here in the Twin Cities, we have a Twin City Cabaret Network. I don't know any other place that has that, but it's all of us artists who come together and we write shows, and we'll do like a 90-minute cabaret where everyone has a 15-minute segment and rotates. But then we'll put on workshops on cabaret and how to really connect to your audience and your lyric, and just a phenomenal and sublime art form. And it could be hilarious and it could be serious, and you could talk about your life. It's just an open format.
I want to end our conversation with you giving me a Barbra Streisand line. And if possible, can you include the word butter?
Well, it's like butter. You're talking about butter? I'm better than butter.
Oh,
I'm
that was it.
Better than butter.
Oh, I'm better than butter was it. You were there.
She's very easy to slip into.
Melody Mendes, thanks. We'll follow you and Barbara down the road.
Thanks, Al.
The website is melodyasbarbara.com. Remember, there's no A in the middle of Barbara. Melody reminded me that the real Barbara dropped that middle A when she was only 19. Melody Mendes as Barbra Streisand, Heidi Center, next Saturday, April 27th, 7:30 p.m. CVCA.net is the website. New York Voices and Virginia Woolf coming up, and next, a good idea gets some wheels on Spectrum West. Support for WPR comes from the Earth Arts Spring Art Tour of the Upper St. Croix Valley, May 3rd through the 5th, featuring artwork at studios, galleries, and arts organizations. Tour guide and map available at earthartswi.org. Ladies and gentlemen, Jim Oliver with What's on Stage.
Thanks, Al. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will present Mr. Poppin's Penguins April the 26th through the 28th in the Oxford Theater. Shakespeare's Greatest Hits will be staged by the Festival Theater tonight, if you're listening on Thursday, and on Saturday, and then April the 26th to the 28th in the Franklin Square Black Box Theater in St. Croix Falls. The musical Adventures of Flat Stanley Jr. will be performed by the Phipps Children's Theater April the 26th through May 5th. At the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson. The Menominee Theater Guild will present Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, April the 26th to the 28th, and May 3rd to the 5th in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. And the St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater in Hudson will present Honky Tonk Laundry, Fridays and Saturdays through May the 18th.
Thank you. A favorite pastime of mine is meeting young people who give me hope for the future. Yes, it's a bit selfish to appreciate more those who aspire to philosophies that parallel mine, but given my age and experience, I have earned and will treasure that entitlement. I met such a young man this week. His name is Austin Northagen. He's director of the Student Office of Sustainability at UW-Eau Claire, where they continue to work on implementing a new bike share program for the city of Eau Claire. We began our chat with the Sustainability Office itself. Now, there are details I'd like to share, but my first thought was this. Of all the fun things that a young person can do, that same young person must be awfully committed and passionate about things to make involvement in SOS one of the extracurricular things that he or she does while attending college.
That's true, yeah.
So you've always been committed, or you suddenly had this passion when you came to school?
I would say 2017, this passion ignited. I ran with it, and I'm really happy that I ran with it, yeah.
What ignited it?
You know, I don't mean to dive into politics too
Do
much.
Do it. I want you to dive into politics. I love diving into
politics. After the 2016 election, my first thought was, what is going to happen to the environment? And I said, I have to do something.
And good for you.
So I got involved in my student government. I found out about this Student Office of Sustainability. I found out about the director position, which pays and gives you a lot of hands-on experience with working with the city and administration and educating students on what it means to be a sustainable steward. Uh-huh. I fell in love with it, and I've just ran with it ever since.
I come from an era where social consciousness kind of was born. Everybody started saying, uh-oh, we'd better care about this.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, it doesn't appear like the adults are going to.
Mm-hmm.
How is it in your generation?
Yeah.
Do you find that there's this seriousness, taking ownership of the future, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I think my generation, the millennial generation, as well as the generation after me, the Gen X, Gen Z.
Sure, whatever. Yeah. Sure. What happens after Gen Z?
I have no clue. That's a great question.
We're done.
I don't know.
Can't start
it. I hope we're not done. I hope that climate change doesn't bring about the apocalypse.
I don't mind being a baby boomer, but I'd much rather have a letter after my... So go ahead. The millennial generation.
I think our generation has really taken on the task, faced the reality that the climate's changing. Things aren't always as they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I always like to draw from my personal examples. Growing up at Christmas time, always snow on the ground. I don't remember a Christmas without it. And then I remember when I turned 16, I was driving home from my uncle's house, and it started raining.
Oh,
and I knew that something wasn't right. And then I started diving into a little more, seeing the ice caps melting, seeing the ozone was an issue. But then now that's being solved a little bit. And now I think this past winter is a perfect example of weather being exaggerated. Because, yes, you can make the argument that snow was going to happen regardless in January.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't make the argument that 12 inches were going to come every day. And yes, that number is exaggerated a little bit, but...
But it seemed that way.
And
this guy comes from Minnesota, folks, just so you know, where snow is just as rampant as it is in Wisconsin.
In the summers, I think we're going to see more 100-degree days than we did the year before and the year before that. And the global average temperatures have risen every year in the last 4 or 5 years. So I guess to go back to your question,
sure.
Al, I think my generation has definitely seen the before and after of climate change, and we know that the worst is yet to come, and being that we are the generation that is young and is going to face the future, going to face the worst consequences of it, I think our generation is really stepping up and said, all right, how can I be part of the solution?
So the office, not just the Office of Sustainability, but the Student Office of Sustainability,
correct.
What kind of history does that have?
So we first came about in 2011 at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. In 2008, a vote was taken by the student body on if they wanted to raise tuition by $10 a semester to create a green fund that would go towards improving infrastructure, educating students, and reducing the carbon footprint of the university.
How'd that go?
And the majority of students said yes.
Well, good for them.
We want to pay more so that we can reduce our carbon footprint.
The cynical side of me wanted to say, oh, you know, the Office of Sustainability is just kind of a university facade, or someone has to do it, that kind of a proposition. But it does appear that young people really, really care about things.
Yeah.
Good. And the things are transportation, energy, waste, climate change, water, food systems, campus ecology, education, and outreach. In the studio with Austin Northagen, he's director of the Student Office of Sustainability at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. We've heard of that, love it. They have a bike share program that's going to start. I guess the wheels have been turning for quite a while, but the actual sharing of the bikes is going to, I guess, happen soon, and we'll get Austin to figure out when that is for us. How can our, Austin, wired society help our environmental concerns? Are there special ways that our connectedness, of which you guys are all masters, by the way, how can that help sustainability? And is it helping?
Being connected over the digital
sure.
age? Yeah.
Is it much easier to just discuss our dilemmas that way? Or is it much easier to get people to come to things because you're so wired and you can get it out?
I think our best outreach tool is a personal connection. For example, because people know me, because I've had personal conversations with them and they meet me, they know that caring about the environment is something that I value. And if they don't act in similar methods around me, I'm going to call them out. It's as simple as recycling. You know, I call my roommate on all the time.
Good for you.
If something goes in the recycling bin, but it's in the trash, I'll take it out of the trash. I'll tell my roommate, hey,
you're
the bin. I think that's our best outreach tool is just personal conversations. But over a digital platform, that makes our outreach much more competitive and accessible and convenient. So I think social media is the first step in getting people to realize it. And the second step is that personal interaction. That encourages the push to the shove.
Do people say, here comes Austin, the tree hugger?
Pretty much, yeah.
Good for you. I love tree huggers. I think they're cool. We have, by the way, here at WPR, been running a public service announcement for quite a while, getting folks jacked up about this bike share thing.
Awesome.
This whole movement didn't just happen yesterday. It's been like 3 years.
Yeah. It's been a three-year process. It started with the Student Senate at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire, which I'm very proud that my peers started this movement. And they've been talking with the city, talking with companies, figuring out how can we bring a program like this here. Uh-huh. And the conversations revolved around a docked bikeless system.
Right.
So that would be infrastructure added, stations around the city added, and then the bikes would go from station to station. And a company would come in and hire individuals to operate it.
Okay.
I started May 2018. And I came in, I said, we need to look at a dockless system. I put together a nice little business plan, presented that to the city, and they accepted my proposal.
Wow.
And then ever since then, I've been working with them on getting the ordinance set, getting that passed by the city council, and now we're in the process of bringing a company to Eau Claire.
How cool is that? There could be a statue of Austin Northagen on the UWEC campus.
There could.
Someday. So you and Eau Claire City Manager Dale Peters met. You know, we've come up with a system that isn't going to cost you guys.
Yeah. So yeah, that was a big thing. We had to make sure that the administrative concerns were taken care of as well as the financial concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Break it down into what the city would be responsible for, what the university would be responsible for, and what the user would be responsible for when riding these bikes, as well as any financial costs, administrative tasks, so on and so forth.
So further explain the dockless thing for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I went online and looked. There are some cities who are already doing it. The bikes are locked, but they're not docked. And the lock is what? Open by scanning a code on your phone? And
yeah, the bikes are dockless. So that means you don't park them anywhere. You can technically park them anywhere, but we encourage you to park them in the designated parking locations. And when they're parked, there's a lock that goes through the back tire, so you can't move it forward or backwards, and you can't pick it up either and transport it, because each bike has a GPS on it. And so the private company would know, oh, look, someone's tampering with our bike. We should get our bike back. You would download the app on your smartphone, scan the QR code on the bike unlocks, and you can ride it off.
And this is all free?
It's not free. 50 cents for every half hour for a student, and then $1 for every half hour for community members.
How can we as people, and we always find a way, how can we screw this up?
Parking in places that you shouldn't. Parking, for example, in downtown Eau Claire sidewalks. Parking in driveways. Parking in neighborhood sidewalks in front of someone's house that isn't your own. Parking in a vehicle parking lot. And if you're caught, you get a small fine.
Okay, so where are the bikes coming from? The private company?
The private company, yes. We've reached out to seven private companies right now, and we're waiting on a response.
So is your May deadline going to work or not?
I do not think so, unfortunately.
Oh,
so
I better change that public service announcement.
Yeah, then. I know. I'm going to reach out to news outlets in the upcoming weeks and inform them that this is the reality. So the original timeline was pass the ordinance in January and February, March to April, sign a private company to operate within the city, and then have that May launch date, but being that it's mid-April and no company has signed on yet.
Is there a reason no one's signing up?
A couple companies have responded and say they don't have a surplus of bikes right now to expand to a new market, and we're still waiting on responses from other companies. I anticipate a launch date could happen this summer, but BikeShare is still going to come to Eau Claire. When? We're still waiting to hear back from some companies.
Back to the Office of Sustainability. Directing it is quite a job. I mean, I read that you guys meet every week.
We do, yes.
Yikes.
Every Thursday at 5. It's an hour-long meeting.
Good for you guys. Way
Thank
to go.
You.
Your generation is starting to feel like my generation.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Responsible.
Thank you.
We're not going to put up with it anymore?
Yeah, that was kind of my approach. I told myself, you know, if I don't do it, who's going to?
That should be the motto of the Student Office of Sustainability. You could have that on the t-shirt.
Yeah.
Austin, thanks so much for coming in.
Of course. It was great. Thank you.
And by the way, that young man graduates this spring. Good news for whatever entity hires him going forward. And my fingers are crossed that there are many Austin-like millennials. With all the attributes that solid people like my father wanted me to notice and display. A firm handshake, looks you in the eye, and does what he says he'll do, or she. We will watch the Bike Share program and provide whatever support we can to get those pedals turning. Stick around to meet New York voices just around the corner. Remember when Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was released in movie theaters? I remember thinking to myself, what a great title. A title by itself made me want to see it. And I see Virginia Woolf is visiting Menominee. Guess who has that story? Jim Oliver.
Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is a dark comedy written by American playwright Edward Albee. Was first staged in New York in 1962. The play won both the 1963 Tony Award for Best Play and the 1962-63 New York Drama Critics Circle Award for Best Play. The film adaptation was released in 1966, starring Richard Burton, Elizabeth Taylor, George Segal, and Sandy Dennis. The Menominee Theater Guild will present Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, April the 26th, 27th, and 28th, and May 3rd, 4th, and 5th in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. Joining us by telephone from her home in Menominee is the director, Susan Colley. Thanks so much for coming to talk to us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm going to ask you first to tell us a little bit about your experience as a director or in theater in general.
Oh, well, I have been acting since high school, also in college, and I was heavily involved in forensics, which is competitive speech. Mm-hmm. And mostly what I did was the interpretants, which included duo, which was part of a play that you pulled out 10 minutes and then presented it for the judges. So I've had a lot of experience personally, as well as being a forensics coach for over 30 years. One of the things that I ended up doing is working with the interp and having them find the intricacies within the characters that they're portraying. Now, I did do something over in Winona, but I also directed at the MTG, Spoon River Anthology, more like a reader's theater format. This is my first directing role for MTG. And I am incredibly excited about it. It's a play that I have loved forever, and the darkness about it is offset a little bit by Albee, as he insists that all of his plays have some humor in it. And even though we're looking at the complexities of two relationships that come together, he still has brought in some very funny aspects to the show. And so it's not completely dark, but it's dark enough.
Well, you know, it's been years and years and years since I saw the movie. I've never seen the play, but according to what I read, they're fairly similar. But I just didn't remember anything funny from it, but maybe it got carried away with the dark side. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Why don't you tell us about the play, and where does that title come from?
Well, the title comes from when Albie was at a party of some sort, and people wanted to know who Virginia Woolf was. And he went, well, you know, I know what she was. She did this, she wrote this, blah, blah, blah. But he decided that a takeoff on Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf. And so the whole show goes through singing Virginia Woolf, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, just like the Big Bad Wolf. And he pulled that into his tragedy about the relationship of George and Martha. They're off at a faculty introductory party, and Martha invites another couple, brand new to the university, over to their house after the party. And George has no idea this is happening, and that right there starts off a little bit of tension between George and Martha. Once the guests show up, oh, the whole play goes into just George and Martha yelling at each other and the new couple, like, what is going on here? And they want to leave, but they keep getting sucked back in. And George and Martha actually utilize that relationship with their new friends as a means of trying to keep George and Martha from fighting too much. But unfortunately, it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Albie, I read somewhere with it, Edward Albee is credited with the Americanization of theater of the absurd.
Yes.
That doesn't really apply particularly to this play, does it, or does it?
No, it really does not.
Mm-hmm.
The only absurdity you could find in it is the way that they lie to each other and some of the things that they break up that unbelievably couldn't be true, but in reality, they are true. So no, he says other shows that have been, I would classify as theater of the absurd, but I don't see Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf as being in that category.
We are talking to Susan Colley, who is director of the Menominee Theater Guild production of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I read somewhere, and this is one of the areas where I really got in over my head as far as preparing for this discussion, but somebody wrote that while other plays establish the difference between reality and illusion, and I guess Albie was known for writing about illusion and reality. But anyway, it said that Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf starts out with illusion, but leans to the former. I didn't understand that, and so maybe you can help if I haven't made it too cloudy of a question.
Mm-hmm. Albie uses the words truth or illusion more than once in the show, and some things occur that looks like reality, but in fact it really isn't. And so it kind of is a complexity for all of the characters who don't know exactly what happened. And so Martha even says, George, truth or illusion, you don't even know. And he says, I don't care. So the illusion becomes reality for some of the people in the show, and it changes the whole concept of what they're thinking about the other individuals.
Mm-hmm.
It's worded beautifully.
Mm.
And you have to pay attention to the show or you're going to miss something that's going to be very valuable later on, as most plays are.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's done in three acts, is that correct?
It is three acts. However, we're going to do the first act and have an intermission, the second act and only have a five-minute break. We encourage people not to leave the theater because the third act is the shortest. Pull them together so it doesn't drag on forever.
Mm-hmm.
It is a three-hour show, but we're working to make it less than that.
Who are the cast members? It's a relatively small cast, isn't it?
It is. There's only four cast members. We have George, who is Stephen Colley, and he is a professor at UW-Stout. Kevin Truskowski, who is the chair of the English and Philosophy Department at Stout. He plays Nick. Karen Wilbur plays Martha, and she is a music teacher. And Honey is played by Macy Kramer, who is a Stout student. So we have four Stout people.
Oh, well.
And one other that is in the show.
Oh, okay.
I also teach at Stout.
I was just sort of wondering, with a small cast, sometimes it's hard to hold, particularly in a long show like this one is, it must be a bit of a challenge for the director and for the actors to keep the interest of the audience.
It is. We try a lot of movement. Part of Albie's show is full of alcohol, and so
oh.
We have a nice bar over there, which people go to constantly.
Mm.
It's the hard for the movement to have them speak to one another on stage, but still not just face each other and talk.
Mm.
So the set is small, and we're going to move them around as much as possible in order to keep attention. But it's really two people and two people and two people and then four all together.
The play is Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf? A dark comedy by Edward Albee. It will run April 26th to the 28th and May the 3rd through the 5th in the Mabel Tainter Center for the Arts in Menominee. For ticket information, you can go online to www.mtgtickets@gmail.com or call 715-231-PLAY. We've been talking to the director, Susan Colley. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
By the way, at the Mabel Tainter in Menominee tonight, if you're listening on Thursday, the comedy of Tommy Ryman, the Canadian Celtic pop music of Searson, is on May 10th. MabelTainter.org is, as Jim reminded you, that website. You're listening to Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. We appreciate you doing so. Support for WPR comes from Wisconsin Indian Head Technical College with a nonprofit leadership program, a fully online program dedicated to help grow nonprofit organizations. WITC.edu/nonprofit.
Goodbye to all we've ever had. Alone where we have walked together, I'll remember April and be glad.
I'll be content in lucky once in April. Your lips were warm and all that spring were new. I'm not afraid of autumn and of sorrow, for I'll remember April and you.
The fire will dwindle into glow.
That is what I believe, the unmistakable sound of New York voices. The song is I'll Remember April. Kind of fits, don't you think? They're an East Coast quartet returning to next weekend's Eau Claire Jazz Festival. They have over 30 years invested in the concept. Darman Meter was there at the beginning, and Lauren Kinnan joined a short quartet of years after that. Darman, you and I spoke in 2015, so you guys were here then.
Yeah, I guess we must have done okay last time because they're inviting us back.
Yeah. Meeting of Minds, most recent CD. It's as much about the band as it is the vocals. There are some complete instrumentals on the album, plus some arrangements that are total pleasant surprises. For instance, when you listen to the intro on track one, you have no idea that Autumn Leaves is down the road, which is kind of cool. So arrangements like that one. Collaborations, yours, Mincer's, whose?
The project was a very unusual collaboration, something that just evolved in a very interesting way. Bob had already written some big band charts for another possible use, but that never really came to be. And then the suggestion came up of collaborating with New York Voices, and we'd met Bob in various settings and just have been huge fans of his band and his music. And likewise, he thought, man, that would be a great idea. So he actually gave me the big band charts to write New York Voices into them. So I kind of describe it as sort of like musical Sudoku. It was like the band was already set up, and I just sort of wound us through in a way that fit with his existing template. And so it made for charts that I think sound like New York Voices, but also sound somewhat different because of just the nature of how we got to the finish line. There are a couple on the album that I wrote the big band charts for, but Autumn Leaves is one of these collaborative ones that was really, really fun to see how it would all evolve, and everybody was really happy with it.
And the other fun thing about the project is that the Voices really do like to embrace the whole instrumental aspect of things, so we're perfectly happy folding ourselves into the horn section and just jumping on to some of the template that was already there for us to play with, you know, folding ourselves into that sound and not necessarily having to be any more or less in front of the sound, you know. So it's a really fun process about how we enjoy being the lyrical aspect and out front, but then just as happy folding ourselves into the whole unit of the big band.
And because you share so much of this project with the band and Bob himself, I had to look him up. He's a busy guy. And every time I think about people like him, I imagine them later in life wondering where all the time went. It flew while they were having fun. And I kind of think that's what you guys are going to do.
Yeah, it's certainly been a ride. If you told us 32 years ago or 31 years ago, whenever we first decided to jump into this crazy life, that we would be still rolling in 2019, that would have seemed just kind of impossible to imagine. But, you know, you just kind of roll along, and next thing you know, you go, where did all the time go?
Yeah.
And here we are.
Started as a quintet, then you went to four. Lauren, you joined in 92. April Fool's Day, I saw.
Yeah, well, it's ironic that that was the day that I joined, but I do feel like it was an incredibly fortuitous opportunity for me to find four other colleagues and friends to collaborate with.
I like bringing up Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross because I enjoy imagining Annie Ross and I are related somehow. But they are pioneers in your craft. So how were you guys sucked into this fabulous crooning category that you sing in? Darman, I read that you were kind of a choral weed early on when others were into other music. But that's, of course, if you look back now, called being ahead of your time.
Yeah, I was, when my friends in high school were listening to Boston or whatever. I mean, I was listening to a lot of pop stuff like Earth, Wind & Fire in Chicago and stuff. But I also had this fascination with Palestrina and Randall Thompson and Benjamin Britten and like real nerdy choral stuff. And I still do to this day. And then I went into, you know, as a sax player, I just got fascinated with jazz and I followed that path into college. But then I got introduced to the vocal jazz world that you mentioned, Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. First of all, it was, for our time, of course, it was Manhattan Transfer was
sure.
The band that was hot, was making a lot of noise. Mm-hmm. So I was paying attention to them. The High Lows, Singers Unlimited was a big one. And I just found it so interesting to hear voices singing the same kind of harmony that I had been studying in big band music and small horn sections and things like that. I was like, man, this is so cool to be singing this. I want to try it. And So when I transferred out to Ithaca College, they had a really nice vocal jazz ensemble, which for its time back in the early 80s, that was, you know, they were hard to come by. So I got lucky and stumbled into this. And that's where Kim and Peter and I all met. It just got us all sort of excited to try to do something professionally. Lauren took a very, very different path.
I was going to ask if at the time you knew that you were one of 60 people vying for the position.
Right. I didn't really know. And I mean, I think there's beauty in naivete.
Yeah.
In a way, I'm glad I just had that exuberant energy of just coming in and going for it and not getting too caught up in who was in line. And also, I think I was fortunate that it was as much about being a good group singer, being a good solo singer, and also being someone who also liked to compose original music. All those things sort of fell on the good side of the basket for me when weighing against other singers. Those were just things that, again, fortuitously, I was very interested in prior to meeting up with the New York Voices. So I had skills that were there. I just didn't know they were going to work out to be the skills that would get me this particular job.
Fun researching, you guys. If you look at photos of New York Voices, you can guess the era by the hairstyles.
Yes, indeed.
And in some cases, the length, Darman, yes.
Yes, or even even the existence thereof.
Darman Meter and Lauren Kinnon with us, New York voices, worth 50% of them, coming to the Eau Claire Jazz Festival. Lauren, you were talking about the solo work and all the other stuff you've done. Darman, you as well. No matter how successful and how busy you are as New York voices, you continue to do all that stuff. Lauren, I have to mention the fact that I loved hearing about your tribute album to one of my all-time buttery voices, Nancy Wilson. Once I was there, I had to listen to her doing The Very Thought of You from 1964, an old video. And for the younger audience out there, I'm talking about the original Nancy Wilson.
Absolutely. No, I know. It is funny when you Google her and Nancy Wilson from Heart comes up as well.
Yeah.
You have to specify jazz singer. She didn't quite give herself as important a jazz singer as I think she was. But I think if you go back and you listen to those records, you realize her organic and very musical way in which she approached her phrasing was very forward-thinking and beautiful. I do think that there's going to be a windfall of people that will sing her praises.
And Darman, when do you find time to play the sax?
Well, at soundcheck. I decided long ago that I was going to be a musician that kind of tried to wear a lot of different hats. In doing so, singing and writing and playing, there is one of the challenges is certainly finding the time to allocate for all those. I was just playing a little bit before you called. Here and there, you just find a window. It is challenging at times to find the windows.
One last thing about the New York Voices aspect of who you are. I liken what you do to dancing, a dance troupe. You guys all have to move at the same time. I mean, this is like vocal choreography, and it gets awfully involved with the rhythms that you guys portray. It makes me believe that you guys rehearse, rehearse, rehearse.
We, in the past, we rehearsed, rehearsed, rehearsed. In the current days, you know, it'd be like a couple that has danced together for their whole life and they can just jump up and instantly look super graceful and like they were just practicing it the day before. We rely on all of that muscle memory and the long history of singing together. We oftentimes can learn a new chart all separated. We actually are forced to do that now because geographically we're very spread out. And so our time of rehearsing together is cut way back, but we rely on all those years of history. But I do like your analogy. It is an interesting thing. It is very choreographed with moments where we each individually get to step out and do our own thing. And you know, in the same way that you might say a big band has that kind of back and forth. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the stuff that happens, it's almost hard to write down as, you know, like here's the rhythm and here's the phrasing. It's almost stuff that just sort of breathes naturally from our many years of doing it together.
And the one difference, though, about the big band that's sitting and reading the music and then they stand up and they do their step out, the reason why I think you liken it to dancing is because we really are all memorized. Mm-hmm. And so the only way you transport music that's so scripted, it's the same writing every night with different solos and different inflections, but you have to find a way to physicalize the music, not just memorize the music from just the brain cells up, but you really have to sort of embody it from your toes to your head. And that's I think, where you feel perhaps that feeling of like you have to dance this music because we really do have all this music memorized. And so that's I think that is how you sort of tattoo it into your DNA or your body. It feels that way, it looks that way, it sounds easy, all that kind of stuff that comes from that fluidity.
The cadence, the rests and the triplets and all the stuff that you guys know exactly where to go.
Right.
That's cool stuff. And congratulations as well on all the jazz camps and everything that you guys do to keep the music going into future generations. And I was just thinking after I found out that we spoke 4 years ago, it's pretty intelligent to come back to a university like every 4 years. You got a brand new audience.
Yeah, the four-year cycle does work. Well, except for those stragglers that can't get it done in 4 years.
Yeah,
we all know a few of those.
Those fifth-year seniors, they get it doubled for you.
Yeah, I got to kick them out of the nest.
Yes. Well, I predict that your impression, your re-impression, I should say now, of the UW Eau Claire Jazz Ensembles will be a good one. I think you probably had a great experience back in 15. We are New York Voices fans here in Wisconsin. Thank you, Darman Meter and Lauren Kinnon, for connecting with us.
Al, I want to mention one more thing, though, if you don't mind.
Do it.
We have a new CD coming. Perhaps by as soon as September or October, you'll be listening to our new record, a collection of Great American Songbook, some originals, some Cuban music, pop covers, and We're very, very excited about having a brand new All New York Voices studio recording for our fan base.
Well, your phrase was, perhaps I will enjoy. You can take the perhaps out of there. I will enjoy it a lot. Thank you, guys.
Our pleasure.
Thanks, Al.
You see what I mean there. I mean, Autumn Leaves kind of just sneaks up on you there. The intro, wow. New York Voices, live and in concert with the UW Eau Claire Jazz Ensemble 1 next Friday and Saturday evening, and you'll hear some of the top-placing college and high school bands from the festival as well. It's all at the Pablo Center, downtown Eau Claire. Tickets at pablocenter.org. Don't forget 52nd Street Friday evening all over downtown Eau Claire. I could listen to that all day. In fact, maybe I will. Meeting of Minds, that's the album from which those tunes are from. Here's a Spectrum memo for you. Citizens Climate Lobby will be hosting a showing of the National Geographic documentary Paris to Pittsburgh on Monday, April 22nd, Earth Day, at the L.A. Phillips Library in Eau Claire, beginning at 6:30 p.m. It'll be shown again Sunday, May 5th, 6:30 at the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire Woodland Theater. It's all free and open to the public, sure. One more. There's a special concert Monday evening at 7:30 in Riverside Theater, the Haas Fine Arts Center at UW-Eau Claire, featuring UW-Eau Claire student musicians and compositions, part of a year-long residency program with Y Music. If you don't know who Y Music is, it's the letter Y in the word music. Look it up. Impressive. Thanks, Erica, Dean, and Kate. Thank you for the audience vibes each week. Keep in touch on Facebook and via email whenever the spirit moves you. And as a reference, if you'd like to hear any part of this or any show again, go to WPR.org, click on shows, then Spectrum West, find the date. For Jim Oliver, I'm Al Ross. Bye.